In the Dominican perspective, the function of grace in relationship to nature is to develop it, to build on it. It was St. Thomas who gave us the phrase that everybody now for seven centuries has been quoting. Grace builds on nature. You can thank the Dominicans for that. Now, of course, as I tell people, you better be sure that your nature can support the grace. All right? Second, grace is a new life. So remember the lineup we had of different viewpoints of grace? In the Franciscan tradition, grace is mainly presence. In the Dominican, it is primarily a new life. So that, as then later on Aquinas would develop at great length, grace is somehow not only to build on nature, but is to follow a path not unlike that of nature. Thus, we speak of our natural life, where the soul is the animating principle of the body. In the Dominican tradition, you would say the soul is to the body what grace is to the soul. Sin is compared with nature. There is a sickness that is fatal or mortal. There is a sickness that debilitates. So there is sin that is fatal and sin that is debilitating. You can take everything we know about nature, and the Dominicans now through 700 years have developed, and this is a library of analogies between grace and nature. Thus, for example, does any human being give him or herself their own nature? Either somebody else gives it to us, or we don't get it. Okay? So in the order of grace, no one gets this divinized nature unless somebody else gives it. It is not enough for nature to be alive, a child just born. I don't know how often babies have to be fed, but at least every day, right? Well, that was an outburst. I know if I were lecturing to the Jesuit scholastics, they would know. Yeah. You can say I know more theology than I know. Child care. But a child must be fed. I am assured more than once a day. So having one's life, notice, nature, it is not enough to have the life. That life must be nourished. Okay? You transfer that to the order of grace. It is not enough to have the life. It must be nourished. Okay? The natural life can be healed. The supernatural life can be healed. The natural life can develop, can grow. The supernatural life can develop, can grow. You name it. All the analogies, and this is now through seven centuries, given that principle. Right? And the insights that we know, it's just the common vocabulary of every believer, right? We just talk this way, developing, growing in the supernatural life. But the whole idea and the theological development of this whole thing was done by the Dominican Order. Theological virtues are above the moral virtues. Well, you say, I suppose they should be. Well, it's not that obvious, because the theological virtues, of course, are faith, hope, and charity, which, by the way, is the way that I always like to write those three. Faith being the foundation of hope and charity. You can't hope in what you don't believe, and you sure can't love what you don't know. You may not love it or her, even though you know them, but they don't have any chance of being loved unless you know them. However, as between the theological virtues, which are these, and the moral virtues, which are prudence, justice, fortitude, and temperance. These are the moral virtues. I cannot tell you how practically valuable in the spiritual life is this very simple statement. Now, the theological virtues are above the moral virtues. Why? Because so much of the spiritual life necessarily has to do with the order of morality. Take the matter of temperance. That means the control of one's sense appetites, food. You can tell whether you're improving, for example, the matter of sobriety or food by the intake. Sex, which is a virtue of temperance. Chastity. Very important, very practical. Fortitude, which is mainly the capacity to endure. And justice, giving everyone his due. And prudence, using the right means to a predetermined end. Now, these moral virtues, which have all kinds of subdivisions, are so much a part of the everyday spiritual life of all of us. Most of our thinking, much of our writing, has to do with the moral virtues. And all the while, we're liable to overlook the fact that the primary purpose of the spiritual life, the primary purpose, is not the moral virtues, but the theological ones. How often do you hear about growing in faith? Or growing in trust? And even when we talk about growth in charity, we often bring it down to this level. And thus, for example, the classes we are taking, the main purpose and the context in which we are speaking for the studies that you are taking, I hope, not unhappily, and I am pleased to be here, is to grow in the virtue of faith. Now, you don't feel particularly more holy. See what I'm saying? See, we've come to so identify holiness or sanctity with morality. And this is the result of 4.5 centuries of cohabitation with Protestantism, for which Christianity is mainly ethical. Now, don't misunderstand me. Good moral behavior, you know, being honest and all the rest, be able to take it, patience is one of the forms of fortitude and temperance, all kinds of self-control, is important, right? Who doubts it? But, objectively, in the eyes of God, which is more important? A person with a strong faith, or the person with, say, titanic courage? It's faith. I repeat, this is no cheap phrase, because as we grow, as we say, in the spiritual life, we look instinctively for development of the moral virtues, don't we? I am more self-controlled. I'm more patient. I deal with people more honestly, sincerely, and all the rest. I'm more prudent. I'm not always putting my foot in my mouth. Or, as I tell people, use your head. So, the presence or absence of moral virtues is so obvious, even to the natural man, right? Is it possible for, I say possible for a person who doesn't have much faith to be nevertheless quite prudent and strictly just and courage and perfect self-mastery? Right? You see what I'm getting at? This is in the order of grace. Now, grace is required here too, but this is one of the great contributions of Dominican spirituality. Took place first things first. We are not to neglect the moral order, but let's not substitute the moral for the theological. And say neglect the cultivation of my faith or my acts of the love of God. Neglect, I say, for the sake of, well, developing a moral virtue which maybe may make me feel that I'm really growing. I must be pretty holy. This can be Pharisaic. No, I don't want to underestimate it. It can be Pharisaic, correct? The Pharisees. Just, and all the rest. Mortified. There are no photographs of Pharisees that we've got, but I'm sure they were all thin men. I'm sure. I can't imagine a stout Pharisee. They'd probably put him out of the sect. Pope John would never make it. Did I get my point across? Third. Sanctity. Now this, you see, is a pickup on the previous one. In the Dominican perspective, the essence of sanctity. Well, first let me say, there's a distinction between now, if I would do this, let's call it goodness. We are all to grow, to use a general term, in goodness, modeled after the goodness of Christ, who is God incarnate. But we can look at our goodness in two ways. Either in its essence or in its function. Now, in teaching the subject theologically, that's why I put the word goodness here, I distinguish between sanctity and holiness. Words are used indiscriminately, and they can be used both ways, and most writers don't distinguish, but I have found it useful. And I identify the essence of goodness as sanctity, and the function of goodness as holiness. Now, to further refine what we're saying, we distinguish between being good in the eyes of God, and, to use bad grammar but good theology, behaving good. Okay? This is in the order of being. This is in the order of activity. Now we are both to be good and to act good. Acting good is, well, moral behavior. And consequently, this is another term for morality. And this, for our purpose, is the presence of grace. Thus a child just baptized. I like to talk about children baptized because I've baptized so few, and I think I've shared some of my experience in baptizing babies. All I know is they contribute nothing. In fact, the less they contribute, the better. The moment the water is poured on their heads, faith tells me that child becomes a child of God, possesses sanctifying grace, the theological virtues, and all the rest. Now, does that child possess sanctity? Yes. Because God is present in that soul, as he is not present in, say, the child, or a child not yet baptized. Okay? Or we, as we say, when we're in the state of grace. The very fact that we are in the state of grace gives us reason for saying, as St. Paul more than once speaks of the faithful as the saints. Remember? All right? So there is a sanctity which is substantial. That's another term. Substantive sanctity. Essential sanctity. The goodness of being. Sanctity as grace. Once you have the concept, you can do all kinds of things with it. You don't trip over your words. Conversely, once we reach the age of reason, which I prefer to call the age of decision, which, by the way, is the only reason we've got a reason. Did you know that? There's only one purpose that we have reason for, and that's to make choices. Honest. Honest. So as we make choices, then we can choose between, say, the good and the evil, or for that matter, the good and the better. Then we begin to exercise the activity or function in the behavioral order. Now, these belong, in essence, these are the theological, these are the moral virtues. Does a child just baptized have the virtue of faith? Mm-hmm. The virtue of hope? Yes. Charity? Mm-hmm. All right. Has a child any degree of moral virtue in the sense of it hasn't started acting yet, right? Now, I repeat, in dealing with souls, good people, but they bristle. Take a man like St. Jerome. You all know about Jerome, don't you? What a temper. The mildest statement that I've memorized, and some of them are almost unquotable, except in Latin, that he used to call people, those especially the heretics, he gave them names. Some have never been translated into English. But here's what he thought of rich people. Have I told you this? Every rich man is either a thief or the son of a thief. Unquote St. Jerome. Now, there are a few exceptions. But you get the drift of his mentality, see? He was a firebrand. Now, if Jerome would be raised to the honors of the altar on the basis of his meekness and sweet, condescending humility, there wouldn't be a Saint Jerome. All right? Don't misunderstand me. We're supposed to work at our humility and meekness. Have you got the point? But the essence is not that morality. The essence is the grace of God in the soul. Okay? And does that make a difference? For one thing, honest. And the older you get, the more comforting it becomes. You say to yourself, Lord, thanks for that distinction. Because you just wish, you could graph, you know, your virtues, the moral virtues, going straight up with the growth in age. I hate to disappoint you. You don't have all that much evidence. Don't you think this is good to hear? See? We're to work at it. See? But what really counts is the life of God in the soul. And God will sometimes allow people, as I've seen it, good people, to labor with limitations and, you know, certain weaknesses of character to their dying day. One of the saintliest men I was taught by, let me name him, Paul de Buscarin. He had a fiery French temper. My confessor, my spiritual director, we related well. In case you don't know, I'm the type too. Well, we used to have to, well, choose among ourselves who would serve his mass. Because if you did anything wrong, well, you heard about it. Once, I remember, somebody said something you shouldn't have said in class. We all ducked. The canon law book came in one direction. He had a very good arm. A very saintly person. Then he would apologize after he'd chew you up. This is good to hear. Okay? At any rate, all of that, all the theological virtues are above the moral virtues, and sanctity being distinguished between the essential and the moral. How much can be hidden behind otherwise meaningless words? When in the Dominican tradition contemplation is spoken of as not merely a means, but the source of apostolic activity, this especially means that the heart of the apostolate is the communication of grace. And consequently, engaging in apostolic work does not mean primarily performing corporal or spiritual works of mercy. They, in fact, are a means to an end. The end of apostolic activity, and surely in the Dominican view, and I would say in every Catholic view, a work is apostolic no matter what you're doing. I cannot tell you how satisfying this is. I may be teaching algebra, or keeping accounts for my community, or cooking in the kitchen. Apostolic activity, in essence, is not the work that I do. It is that through that work, I obtain grace for those in whose favor I work. And consequently, it is one thing to think of contemplation which a person, as it were, uses to strengthen his spiritual life, to draw closer to God, to have the strength and motivation and wisdom to then go out into the active apostolate. Now, contemplation is that. It is the source of strengthening the apostle, of deepening his or her convictions, of enabling the person to be equipped for work in whether the spiritual or corporal works of mercy. Well, that I would say is in the order of means, whereas here contemplation is more than just that. It is that, but it's more. My union with God, which is the essence of contemplation, is that by being contemplative, united with God, I then might bring God to others where, depending on how closely I am united with the source of grace, no matter what I do, whether I peel potatoes or teach metaphysics. Does he see the difference? And all I can tell you is, I think, for many religious, the notion of contemplation is rather on this level. We don't minimize its importance. I need strength. I need light. But that kind of presumes that the most important, role of the apostate is to do the work. It's not. Honest. It's not. Qua apostolate. Whatever I do, it is that I might be used as an instrument of God to communicate His grace. Our Lady, who never preached a sermon, never wrote a book, right? Who would doubt she was a channel of grace? And that because of her very close union with God. Now, 3 centuries later, Ignatius would build on this premise. This is a new idea. New in the sense that until Dominic and Francis came on the scene, and they are really contemporaries. Now, the difference, as I tried to make clear last time, is not so much that Francis had different ideas than Dominic, but that Dominic, besides the focus of the apostate being more in the learned, the leaders, and so on, that in the Dominican tradition there was reflection, theologizing, understanding what they were doing, and what you are doing here, you are uniting yourself with the source of grace in order that, being thus united, you can speak the most, the most ordinary prose and be boring, and people will be turned off. They won't tell you what a fine sermon you gave, and they may see what a poor teacher he is or she is, but God will use you, and it might be with the very humiliation and being a bum teacher. See the difference? He is the very instrument that God uses to sanctify those whom you have bored by being a good teacher. Isn't that different? Well, the instrument hardly even knows that he or she is an instrument. Okay? That's the second last one. And finally, whatever else Dominic brought into the church, it was not so much he, but his followers, notably Thomas Aquinas. It was to lay to rest once and for all which is the highest state of life in the Catholic Church. It is the combination of being both contemplative and apostolic, or if you wish, to be both a man and woman of prayer and active in laboring for souls. Now, the reason for that, as Aquinas was later on to explain, is, of course, Christ himself. The secret is the Spirit of God in each of our souls to see the meaning that once you realize that it doesn't matter at all what you're doing. Because the purpose of the apostolate is not to do the work, right? Is to bring grace to souls. And if Dennis, who mops our floors in New York, whom I regularly see when I go up to Mass at 6:25, he's already mopping floors, and I stop to talk to him for a few minutes, well, he's a good man. I say God bless you to him, and whenever we part, I give him a chance to say, God bless you. He's a grace to me. I think of my mother, who cleaned office buildings to see her son, her only son, through school. I'd be out of my mind if I didn't think that that humble woman did not win grace for those whose lives she entered. Especially this nondescript individual. On this level, it doesn't matter a bit what you're doing. What matters is that the instrument is united with God. And the instrument is not united with God, no. God may, he permits all kinds of things to happen. He permitted the world to be redeemed by his death on the cross. But then it'll be in spite of the person's lack of sanctity that some good will be done, but not because of it. Are we making sense? And consequently, we would expect the last item to follow on the second last. Because then you do not dichotomize or distinguish, as I think we have mistakenly come to distinguish, don't you think, the active from the contemplative. And part of it, of course, I might just as well spend a minute or two on this, because it's part of the history of the situation. When, in the 16th century, the church began to approve, very gingerly at first, as we shall see in a few minutes when we start talking about Ignatius, when she began to approve what are now called apostolic communities. The Society of Jesus was the first to have its constitutions approved, allowing for both solemn and simple vows. Prior to Ignatius, no simple vows recognized by Rome. This opened the door for communities like yours that take simple vows, in which, especially women, on a scale and to an extent that was unknown 400 years ago, are engaged in a far-flung apostolate throughout the world. Prior to the 16th century, and then finalized by St. Vincent de Paul when he founded the Daughters of Charity, the only women's communities recognized by the church were what we now call contemplative. Okay? But they never called themselves contemplative. Honest, they didn't. Then after the division, especially among women's communities, once the division was made between those with simple vows and those with solemn vows, those who continued in what had by then been a 15th century tradition among women, okay? This started the exact date of 1637. These are women. This, among women, goes back to, well, the Ascension of Christ, about 37 A.D. In other words, the cloistered contemplative life was the life that the church recognized for women for 15 centuries. Okay? Once the change was made and Rome approved what we now call, the word is unfortunate, active communities. I'm talking about women. Then those who remained in that constant tradition, who remained cloistered contemplatives, as we now call them, began calling themselves contemplatives. Am I making sense? It is not as though, and of course this is the sad part of it, is not as though those of us, or speaking of you, who are under simple vows, where your existence is only about 3 centuries old in the Catholic Church, are not to be contemplatives. The Dominican spirituality has clarified immensely for all of us. We are all beneficiaries. Contemplation has as its purpose to unite the instrument with God so that thus united, the instrument might bring grace to everyone who touches our lives.
This concludes Father Hardin's lecture on Saint Dominic. On the next tape, Father Hardin begins his lecture on St. Ignatius of Loyola.